Okay, well, I apologize for not wearing a tie. It's because of the heat. Linda's already given me absolution on that, so. So the session that I put together for today is one more session on consent. You're probably getting sick and tired of consent, but it seemed to me as I looked over the issues that we might want to address this year, consent and conflict of interest were the two largest groups. And Linda just gave me another news release today about just now about another topic that we might want to investigate. I have one or two more sessions on consent that I'm thinking about, but I'd like some feedback from you about whether they're appropriate or not, so we'll come back to that at the end. But I thought we would spend some time talking about vulnerable individuals as research subjects. The North American model for medical research is what we call the rational choice model. Although we did touch just briefly last time when we talked about research in children on one of the other models, the social contract, that people may have an obligation to participate in research for the good of humanity. But that's not the dominant model. And in this rational choice model, there are, again, three criteria for valid consent. You have to have a competent subject or consent or surrogate consenter. They must be given adequate information, and they must make a voluntary decision to participate. Now, when we talked about children last time, it was a matter of competence. They're not competent to give consent, so how do we get adequate surrogate consent? But what I'd like to talk about today is subjects who may be subject to coercion, because that's the third element of consent. Not competence, not adequacy of information, but voluntariness. So coercion is really at the end of a spectrum. when I teach students about this issue, the spectrum starts with education. Part of our job as physicians is to educate patients. Then we move over to persuasion. If we're convinced that a particular treatment modality is in the patient's best interest, we can try to persuade them if they're reluctant. And then we can move from there into manipulation, which is when you really, really, really want them to do it, and you may overemphasize the benefits and underemphasize the the risks or burdens in order to get them to consent. That's wrong. We shouldn't do manipulation. And pushing that even further is coercion. And this is a spectrum without bright lines between them. But it's really considered not appropriate to use manipulation or coercion. And coercion is compulsion by physical or moral pressure, which we generally think of as an effort by the person who is trying to obtain consent to pressure the person. And that's coercion. But also, there's the possibility that the potential subject's condition may be coercive rather than the person trying to obtain consent. So let's look at some different groups of vulnerable subjects. One I call captive subjects, which includes prisoners and soldiers. And these are individuals who can be controlled to some extent, or perhaps their rights, basic rights, have been limited, truncated. So is there participation research? Is it voluntary or is it coerced? Is inducement that you offer to these folks coercive? And prisoners and soldiers were often used in research in the past, and some historical evidence of abuses, so society has become much more protective and much more prohibitions in this area. Looking first at prisoners, some would say, well, they owe a debt to society. And in fact, life in prison is coercive. They have lost some segment of their individual human rights. And I was amazed to read, I had no idea that the percentage was this high, but in the early 1970s, 90% of pharmaceutical research was done on prisoners. Isn't that amazing? Cosmetics. I'm going to get to that in just a moment, because that was a real a real problem in Philadelphia. Now, some of this research done earlier was productive, like that on polio and malaria and dengue fever. But there are many abuses, and this book that I mentioned here talks about cosmetics and dermatologic research, and it really blows your mind. If you're interested in this at all, I would really recommend you reading Acres of Skin by Alan Hornblum. The title comes from the fact that when he was taken into a prison yard, he had been talking about doing research there. He was taken into a yard and he saw all these men walking around without shirts. And he said, "Wow, look at those acres of skin." And he did a lot of research studies on cosmetics and dermatologic medications. And the prisoners volunteered, they gave consent, but they were offered some money. Not much, but some, and a little bit of money in prison can be coercive. Or favored treatment. Maybe they would be allowed out in the exercise yard for a longer period if they consented, with even the hint of possible early release. Or it would look better on your record if you come up for possible probation if you have volunteered for this. And unfortunately, many of these men ended up with scars on their skin, and a few even died from topical application of caustic materials. Then since 1974, when things sort of opened up with the Belmont Report forthcoming not too long after that and so on, major protections were introduced so that now hardly any research is done in prisoners. And so we could ask the question, has the pendulum swung too far? Is complete prohibition justified, or is it okay to use prisoners and allow them to take a small risk for perhaps a change in the boring routine or even for a small benefit? I don't know the answer to that, but you may be asked to address that if a protocol comes up using prisoners as subjects. Soldiers, another category of individuals who are required to accept all necessary medical interventions. And so you could ask, is research on unapproved drugs acceptable if the intent is to protect the soldier? And we're going to come back to that in a minute in relation to the Gulf War. But I would like to remind you again of the history of some of the Nazi experiments which got so radically out of hand. But remember, the focus of most of those research protocols was to benefit the military, to see how long the airmen could survive in ice water of the North Sea. The consequences of that are just too much to even think about. But remember, that was the basis of why they were doing this. And some military research in the past has been quite ethical. Remember Walter Reed with the yellow fever experiments? And in fact, his board of trustees volunteered to participate, and one of them died. but some has been unethical. Mustard gas in World War II, radiation and LSD and other hallucinogens during the Cold War. Where I went to medical school, one large, very prestigious psychiatric hospital was involved in some of the hallucinogenic experiments, and it came out later on that was really inappropriate. So because of these excesses and abuses in 1991, the Department of Defense raised the standard to the same of other federally funded research. But it's possible to get a waiver if you jump through the right hoops. And during the Gulf War, waivers were obtained to study pyridostigmine and botulinum toxin. Again, with the idea that these troops may be exposed to chemical warfare, biologic warfare, and so if we can do these experiments and find out if they really work, that could possibly benefit them. Now, currently, there's ongoing discussion, and I don't know the answer because I don't think it's been resolved yet, of whether either of these agents might be implicated in the Gulf War syndrome. So I think we have to be very cautious even about waivers. And so for political and moral reasons, there's reluctance to use soldiers if there are other subjects available. A third group of individuals is subjects with incurable progressive disease. And here we think primarily of malignancy that's no longer curable. But the same thinking could be applied to AIDS research, ALS, and other conditions, dementia perhaps. So this is where the question comes up. Even if the investigator is not coercive, is the disease itself coercive? Is the subject or the potential subject under such pressure, feeling I've got nothing to lose, there's no other options, therefore I will consent to this research? And just a reminder that phase one studies, which I often refer to as studies to see if you can take this and survive, but they're really toxicity studies looking also at metabolism, absorption, elimination, preferred route of administration, safe dose range, and so on. And phase one oncology trials have blank. What response rate? What percentage of subjects will benefit in a phase one study? Less than 5. The last study I read was 4%, and I've seen them as low as 1%. So it's very, very few subjects benefit from participation. But a survey was done of subjects in phase one trials asking, what do you think of the chances that you will benefit? What do you think the results were there? About 60%. And that's including the idea that probably half of them are going to be in the placebo arm. So there's a very high degree of what's called the therapeutic misconception, that people think they are patients who are being treated by physicians rather than that they are subjects being looked at by investigators. And the question comes to mind, and I don't know the answer to this, are the subjects misinformed, or do they just misunderstand, or do they have denial and are just reaching out in their desperate situation? But I think that's really up to you folks to look at the consent documents, the consent process, to see what is going on. You may remember ACT UP, who's an organization of advocacy for HIV-positive patients back, maybe they're still active, I don't know, but back 10 years ago or so. And their slogan was, a drug trial is healthcare too. Wrong. It's not so. But they were saying we should have access to experimental drugs because we have no other options. Now there are other options, but I think this is the mindset of many people in society that we need to have access to experimental treatment. And HHS said 30 years ago, notwithstanding the fact that some individuals within HHS may not concur, they admit that not everybody agrees with this. The official position of the department in regard to phase one studies of anti-cancer drugs is that they are potentially therapeutic. Potentially therapeutic. And I guess that's true, if depending on how you define potential. But the remedies, the desperate remedies justification is really quite troublesome, because there are some things that are worse than death, like very poor quality of life. I mean, I can't put myself in these shoes, but if I were terminally ill with no recognized treatment options, would I consent to a study that has a less than 5% chance of benefiting me and a 50 or 80% chance of causing me decreased quality of life for my remaining time? It's hard to know when you're put in that corner how you would respond. But I think that you folks have a very important job at looking at this to be sure that subjects understand as clearly as possible. George Annis, who's an attorney, ethicist, frequent contributor to the New England Journal, has written a piece in defense of people who are terminally ill entering into research. And he says that we should expand the regulations. This has not been done, but this is his proposal, that if a person has 6 months or less to live, which is the Medicare hospice definition, even though we all know that 6 months is so difficult to predict. But he says that if these folks are going to be asked to participate in research, there should first off be a reasonable probability of improving their health or well-being. That takes it out of the 5% category and moves it way up. What's reasonable? It's hard to say. And there must be no reason to believe it will significantly decrease their quality of life. That's going to be tough. And you must have written consent from the subjects obtained by a physician, patient advocate, somebody separate from the research trial itself, who was really on their side and acting in their best interest. And that person might be required to monitor the research as well. And he proposes that the protocol, financial arrangements, and the vote of the IRB be available to the public. Now, these are pretty high standards, but these are things that you might consider when, I mean, you can impose this sort of thing in a protocol that's presented to you, so you may want to consider adding some of these things when it seems appropriate. Let's move on to students as research subjects. The potentially coercive nature of this is that the student may feel intimidated, may feel that failure or some other retribution would be a consequence of not being willing to consent. And students are available, they're generally reliable, they usually need money, might even consider them captive. And also, medical students in particular, healthcare professionals, students in particular, should have a better understanding of the consent process and the research itself. But there was a death of a student at the University of Rochester about 15 years ago. She died after bronchoscopy, and I forget now what the research protocol was and what was the actual cause of death, but this really escalated the discussion and the idea of using healthy students as research subjects. Sad situation. And so because of that, there's been, again, more oversight, more restrictions. You know, when I was a medical student, and this was back in the dark ages, before IRBs, but my wife was putting me through medical school, and we had a sudden, unexpected family, and she stopped working. And boy, we were scratching for money. And so I volunteered for everything that came along. I mean, I had skin windows put on, or they took a little grinder and made holes in my arm and put glass over it to see what kind of cells came out. And $10 a piece, man, I would go and get a dozen of them at a time. And then I volunteered for one project because it offered $300. That was a lot of money in the 1960s. And this was to have an injection of synthetic ACTH. It required taking all my meals and sleeping in the hospital and connecting 24-hour urines and giving frequent blood tests and so on. And after about 3 weeks of this, I was sick and tired of it. And I went to the PI and I said, I want out. I want to quit. And he wouldn't let me out. He really turned the screws. And I stayed in for the rest of the study. I got my $300 very thankfully. But it was a different ballgame back then.
But it made your
nemesis
right.
It made me nemesis right. So is the financial inducement itself coercive? And we're going to talk about conflicts of interest in some coming weeks or sessions. And finally, I wanted to address subjects who are poor or without insurance, because their condition can be coercive as well. Poverty can be a significant inducement, and access to medical oversight and the possibility of receiving treatment. And remember again the Tuskegee study, which, as I think I mentioned in one of our earlier sessions, when it was started in 1932, you might be able to justify it because there really wasn't any effective treatment for syphilis. Salvarsan really wasn't very, very effective. But the subjects were poor, happened to be black men in Macon County, Georgia, who were offered this medical oversight. And they were brought to clinic and tests were done, including lumbar punctures, and they were given Tylenol or aspirin or whatever and other things, and they thought they were being treated. And but then after penicillin came along, it was not given to them, and for 30 more years, they were continuing the study, 30 years. But looking back on it, part of the inducement to be part of that study was their poverty. So there's an interesting study that I cited there by Paul Applebaum and associates, looking at the motivation for volunteering subjects. And they found surprisingly to me anyway, that access to better care was a stronger motivator than money. So maybe I'm overly concerned about this, but I think we can't ignore it. And I mean, and offering subjects reimbursement for travel and time and so on is appropriate. But when you start offering them $25 extra per session when they come to the lab or whatever, $25 probably wouldn't turn my head or yours, but to some people, $25 is a real significant income. So those are some of the issues involving potential coercion of research subjects. Questions, comments? I might... Employees?
Into this, like the students,
mm-hmm. That's right. And people who work in these research labs are often, you're healthy. Can we look at your DNA or whatever?
So they have a relationship with trust,
yep,
and friendship.
Yep.
A lot of
good point. I did find that that article by George Annis that I mentioned very very good, and I made just a few copies. I didn't think everybody would be interested, but there are a few here, and I'll leave one with Linda in case you are. The title is "The Changing Landscape of Human Experimentation, Nuremberg, Helsinki, and Beyond." It's really a historical, and then he goes on looking specifically at subjects who are terminally ill. And he's not a fan of the Helsinki guidelines. He's really quite critical of them on a political basis. Yeah, I know. It was just updated just a few years ago. Yep. Right.
I always wonder about ethical guidelines.
Then we get into the concept of natural law.
What?
Well, I would be glad to debate that with you sometime, because some of the provisions, you're right, the provisions are obsolete, but the reasoning behind them is still valid. I mean, Leon Cass wrote an excellent analysis of the Hippocratic Oath and comparing it to common practice and so on. He said the reason that surgery was forbidden was not because there's anything inherently wrong with it, but because surgery prior to antisepsis almost always led to death. Well, and it was surgery for the stone, so it was cutting for kidney stones. And if you left the stone that was trying to pass, if you leave it alone, it just might pass, and the patient might survive. But if you operate on it, they're going to get septic, and they're going to die. And so the reasoning behind it is still valid, even though some of the provisions are wrong.
But that's why these kinds of things should matter for the underlying reason rather than specific.
Right. Other comments, questions? If not, the two remaining issues in consent that I thought I might look at are cross-cultural research, international research, and emergency research, because it's impossible to get valid consent from somebody who's in a traumatic coma or hypovolemic shock and so on, and so there are really special protections for them. So I thought I might look at those two. I don't know if I can do them in the same session or if we need two sessions. And then transition over into conflicts of interest.
I have a question. So how will the IRB know if research being done to students and employees is ethical and non-coercive?
Well, I mean, I think you have to look at the protocol itself and how it's going to be implemented and talk with the PI. And it's going to be a judgment call. There are not any clear guidelines that will say yes in and yes or no out. But I think my goal was to sort of raise your awareness of some of the questions rather than just saying, oh, okay, they're students, whatever. Really need to look more seriously at any population that has the potential for coercive influence.
Andy? If I understand what you're saying, too, from last time, did you say this is true, that prisoners have more protection than infants in human research now?
The question is whether infants have more protection than prisoners in human research. I don't.
I was saying prisoners.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Prisoners have more protection than infants, because infants can't consent.
Infants cannot consent.
Actually, irrational.
Right.
At least have the potential to judge whether they're being
forced. Right. But in current practice, we can do research on infants by getting surrogate consent. But the practice is that we're very protective of prisoners at this point because of the issue of coercion. So I'm not sure that we can compare apples and oranges there, but it's a valid question, worthy of some thought that I don't have a quick response to. Sorry.
Yeah. We'll have to compare subparts B, C, and D to see who has the best protections
under the regulation. Right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, we'll go on to item number